Hey everybody, welcome to a special episode of Live from My Drum Room. As I approach my fourth anniversary and almost 200 episodes, today I'm bringing you a best of Live from My Drum Room going back to 2020 when I started this crazy idea 4 years ago. I will be back with new episodes very soon, but in the meantime, enjoy this. And I do want to take this opportunity to thank you once again for watching and listening and supporting Live from My Drum Room. If you haven't already subscribed, it's not too late. I'm approaching 5,000 subscribers. So thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. I'll see you on the other side. Enjoy.
So I gotta tell you, I remember, I don't know how many years ago, it was probably more than I can even realize it was, but I got a call from Greg Bissonette one day, the day after you had sat in with the Ringo and the All-Star Band in Florida.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and he was raving about how you played with a little help from my friends. You guys double drum with Ringo up front.
That was cool.
Yeah, and I mean, I just want to highlight that because I know Ringo was a huge influence in the Beatles. So to be up there playing with him had to be like otherworldly. And
I'm playing like this kid. You know, yeah, and I think I was in a blur, but I think he kind of introduced me, which was almost more than like, you know, like, we were out on the road with Dylan back in the late 80s, and Ringo came to a show, probably in London. And I remember somebody said, you know, oh, I remember Bob's doing his thing. You know, he doesn't need the band. He's doing the Bob thing. And I'm getting up off the drum kit and I look over and I see my flight case and Ringo's sitting on my flight case. Now, I don't know about you, but this is one of those things when you meet someone that you idolize, it's not that you don't want to meet them unless you actually have something to say. Like, so I feel like, well, maybe I have something to say. He's at a gig, he's on my flight case, he probably noticed that I was playing drums. This will be the appropriate time. And the guy goes, would you like to meet Ringo? And as I'm walking over, I'm trying to figure out what's going to come out of my mouth. Well, what came out of my mouth was so horrible. He's still sitting down, and I said something to the effect of, Ringo, wow, I want to thank you for my haircut, my house, my car. And as God is my witness, he reaches up and he hugs me, and he pats me on the back, and he goes, I know. And I realized every drummer has walked up and shit the bed. And
yeah.
I think that's what came out of my mouth was something about like for my pants. I don't know what I was saying.
Yeah. But it was sincere. You were being honest. Yeah. Yeah.
My entire purpose for being.
Yeah.
It was like, it was just.
The first time I met him, Stan, I said something like, so I think back about it and I was so stupid and like he's heard a million. I said something like, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be a drummer. Yeah. And I think he said, I've heard that before. But I got to tell you, Greg, God is my witness. And he would tell you this, said to me without naming any names. He said, a lot of people come up and sit in with the All-Star Band and play that song. You know, if they're in St. Louis, they might get. And he said, nobody played it like Stan. Nobody played the shuffly feel the right way. And I think even Ringo either commented to Greg or commented to you, I don't know, but noted it like, okay.
Well, here's a sidebar. I shedded it, man. Like Greg sent me a video and it's like, I'm not gonna lie to you. It's like, if you're going to, because he said, you'll probably get called up if you come to the show. And I wasn't going to take any chances. It was like, I want to know how you guys play this. And I shedded the fact that he didn't play crash cymbals after the big fill.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, it's like, because even Greg was like going like, wow. All right. Yeah. And it was like, I want this. It's Ringo, man. You know what I mean? I'm not taking any liberties. I'm not going to show him how the song goes. You know what I mean? It's like, you know how.
Did you play the big fill? Did you take that?
Greg and I played it exactly the same. It was pretty close. And but Greg is also like, you know, come on, there's a guy. You want to sit next to Greg and play drums. You know, it's like playing tennis with John McEnroe. You know, if John wants to make you look good, you get all baseline shots to, you know, it's like, if he wants to make you look like an idiot, that'll take about a second. You know.
And then we got around to doing Crazy Love, and you know, we talked about Crazy Love, and I said, oh, this is just Van Morrison's soul music. This is just, I mean, he's using his falsetto. Listen to this thing. We got to give this a treatment. So after we cut the track, and I used real tight brushes, and we brought the mics down and brought the mics in, and I said, this is going to be really soft. I told Elliot, bring them down. I'm going to play really soft. I'm not going to hit hard, but just grab that motion. Make sure you grab that motion. As soon as we finished it, being in New York City, I realized, I saw over in, that day in the studio, the big golden set of Musser vibraphones that was delivered from SIR. They did not take them back, and they were still there. And I was like going, okay, here we go. Because I've been playing vibraphones since I was 12 years old. And just just for orchestration, not that. And I said, Van, can I put that on the, he said, oh, sure, go ahead. I'm going to read some bass. So I told Elliot, I said, Elliot, mic it real close, and I'm going to do a slow rotation. And I went to do that, and I realized, oh, there are no mallets. Cute. And I was almost defeated. I said, hold on a minute. Is there a maintenance room or something? He said, yeah, check it out. So I found Craftsman screwdrivers at that time, and they had rubber handles on them, right? I couldn't find four to work with four, so I've had three.
Oh.
So that part was played with screwdrivers.
Unbelievable story.
And it came out beautiful. So then I wound up mixing. I stayed behind. Everybody went back up to Woodstock, and I said, I want to stay here. I want to sleep in the studio. Elliot, can I sleep in the studio? Sure, don't tell anybody. I'm going to stay here. We're going to start mixing in a day. Okay, I want to stay. I'm going to stay in Manhattan. And we did. And I admitted to Elliot, I said, you know, every time you turned around and we were mixing Moondance, I kept kicking the vibraphones up. So that's why when you put the cut on, as soon as you hear Van say those first three words the vibraphones hit, that's because they were knocked up. Each time we did a mixtake, I said, now they're where they should be. And
good on you, Gary.
That's why it sounds like it did, because the vibraphone is always mistreated or never used as a major instrument to capture the flow. And I pushed it up.
And not to take anything, Van's vocals are so beautiful in that song, but the vibraphone part that you play, the way it just, it fills the whole thing. It's just, it's
slow
gorgeous.
Rotation. My sound is a slow rotation, and I use very soft mallets, the gray Musser mallets, and I usually use four.
Yeah.
But I purposely use that because now one more thing about Van Morrison and all that stuff, those are real vocal takes. He never overdubbed a lead vocal. Wow. That is it. So that's whatever you're hearing on any of those, that's all, that's what you got.
That's it. It's like he might do a few takes, but it's all,
they
all
didn't
real.
Do a compilation and filling up the track and then picking the best phrase from each one, and then none of that went on. That was just, that was like real stuff. There was no manipulate. You couldn't manipulate that. Just but there was no manipulation capabilities at that time.
I think what I love so much about the record is, besides the cuts, I mean, the songs are timeless, but it sounds like a live recording in terms of everybody being in the room at the same time. And
they were. We were. Yeah. The horns.
There was a session with Brian. It was the Heaven session, the song Heaven. We were at the power station.
Yeah.
And I had a rehearsal at SIR with Hall & Oates that day. And Brian wanted to record. So I was in New York staying, and I talked to him, and he said, no, it's cool. We'll get going on the song. You know, you go do your rehearsal and come back and we'll record it tonight. You know, so okay, so we got in early that day. We got in the studio and we set up and we ran through the song a couple of times. And I, you know, I'm looking at my watch and buddy, I'm really sorry, man. I got to go. And yeah, okay, no problem. Just, you know, so I'll see you later. So I went, great. I'll come back as soon as I'm done. Rehearsal's only a few hours. I'll be back. So I go out, go rehearse with Daryl and John, and I go flying back down to Power Station. And I walked in and they're listening back to the song and it's all done. Steve Smith is standing in the control room. And my first reaction was, that's Steve Smith. Whoa, I get to meet Steve Smith, who at the time was absolutely like just one of my, listen to the stuff this guy plays, you know?
Yeah.
And so everybody kind of looks at me like, uh-oh, or whatever. And we listened to the song. It was unbelievably good. The drum track is so good on that song. Steve plays so beautifully.
He got lucky, Mickey. That's it. It was just luck.
So I don't know what happened. But anyway, Brian's, oh, Mick, yeah. Hey, listen, you know, Steve was in town and I was talking to him on the phone. I said, you want to come down? And he came down and we just put the track together. And I went, buddy, it's fine. You got an amazing track. And, you know, Steve was so kind and sweet and nice,
yeah.
And, you know, really nice. So anyway, that was the one day where those two gigs sort of clashed and crossed paths, and I didn't come out the other end very well from either of them, but it was okay because the song's great and is a huge hit for him. And
one of the funniest things I read in the book was the story of you being on tour with the Eagles and the those shoes.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you could tell that story.
Well, I don't know what city it was, but it was a great big place and we're playing. And there's a song called Those Shoes. It's on the Long Run album. And it's funky. Da-dun, 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 right? It's really cool. Great song. Anyway, Don Felder, Joe Walsh have dual talk box solos in that song. It's just killer. It's really cool. And it gets just crazy and the solos are great and it's jamming and all that. And I'm staying locked into the groove and all that. And at the end of the talk box solo, I was so inspired that I played a zika-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka- it, and it just because I was, we were feeling it, right? You know, and we go for it, you know. I
mean, yeah, sure.
That's what you kind of think you should do, anyway. And so, and I didn't. Nobody thought of it. It didn't matter. We and then we ended the song, when we finished the show, and we go back to the hotel, and about an hour after I got back to the hotel, my phone rings in my room, and it's Henley, and. He never called me on the phone, right? So he calls me Joe Bob because he's from Texas, and he labeled me as Joe Bob. And I think it's because then when he'd go, Joe Bob, Joe Walsh didn't turn around. He, you know, anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So he says, Joe Bob, he says, come up to my room. I went, okay. And he never did that, right? So I go up to his room, and I knock on his door, and he opens the door, and the chain's still on the door, you know, just that kind of a thing. Opens the door, chain's still on the door. And he looks at me and he goes, hey, you know that drum fill coming out of the solos in those shoes? Because, listen, the guy knows every measure of every song of every show. He listens. He's so, you know, concentrated and focused, you know. Anyway, so I'm thinking, oh, man, he's going to compliment me. How cool is this, Don Henley? So he goes, you know that drum fill coming out of that? I said, yeah. He goes, he looked at me like this. He goes, don't do that. And then he says, have a good night. And he shuts the door. And I'm like, oh, God, I'm crushed. So that's not even half of it. So the next day we're in another show. We got another show and we're getting ready for sound check. Glenn Frey, God bless him, rest his soul. Glenn Frey comes over to me and he pulls out $100 bill. He said, here, and he said, play that fill again. I said, there's not enough zeros on that bill for me to play that fill again.
That's pretty damn crazy, huh?
I appreciate you guys telling these stories on my show. This is going to make it even more special.
Can you guys
relate that? I know there's a story about George Harrison coming in to buy a drum kit. Yeah, maybe you could tell that.
Oh, shit. Well, the backup on this one, we called it I'm choking on my tongue. We call it the greatest day in the history of pro drum. Because this is 1983. We talked Bob into, we got to take these things called credit cards, Bob. You know, everybody just doesn't have the cash anymore. Yeah. So he agreed. We took credit cards. And then 2 weeks later, we get a chargeback. He comes in yelling and screaming at us, going, "You're going to ruin the place. We're going to go out of business. This credit card." So, we're like, "Oh no," you know. So he goes, "This is the law. I don't give a shit who comes in. You call the credit card number in." We're like thinking, "All right, we'll do it because we want to keep using it. It's the younger generation now." So then, the first customer of the day comes in. It's Neil Diamond to buy his son a drum set, and I'm waiting on him, and all I'm thinking about is, please don't give me a credit card. So he comes to $2,800. He hands me a credit card, and I'm thinking, oh shit! I go to the rotary phone to call the number in.
Oh,
so
man.
I give the guy the number, and the guy on the phone goes, "Hey, that's Neil Diamond's credit card." I go, "Yeah." I go, "Is it any good?" He goes, "Is it Neil Diamond?" So he's mocking me. So then right around 5 o'clock, we get a phone call from Jim Keltner. Jim says, "Hey, I'm running late. Can you guys stay open a little bit?" We're like, "Yeah, Jim, for you. Sure. No problem." Jim comes in with George Harrison. And we're like, "Oh shit." And this is the 83. He goes, "George wants to buy Ringo a Christmas present." We're like, "Great." So what does Bob do? Bob grabs him and takes him to the most expensive thing in the house. And that was the 1983 Gretsch 100th anniversary drum set. And I'm so glad he did it because it dates the time when he came in because Bob tried to sell it to him. So he ended up, Ringo's got plenty of drums. He says, "I just want to give him a little couple of stocking stuffers." So it's like he bought him a couple of Zildjian t-shirts, a couple sticks with lights in them that light up. And then we're all standing back. He hands Bob a credit card the day he laid the law down. And we're all like, "Oh no."
Yeah, you're going to call it in, Bob.
So Bob didn't call it in. And so he had to eat crow the day he laid the law. That's why we call it the greatest day in history program.
I remember, the great drummer Colin Bailey.
Yes.
And he used to do a TV show in the 70s called Fernwood Tonight. It was like a fictitious late night show, right?
Yes.
And what's his name? Was the fake host.
Martin Mull.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. And the house band's name was Happy Kind and the Mirthmakers. And he was the drummer in the band. So this would have been 30 something years ago. I was having dinner with a group of people. Colin Bailey was there and he told this story about your dad. And he said, I just think it's hilarious. He said, while they were doing that show, he went to see Buddy play in Hollywood somewhere in the 70s. Right. And he sort of knew Buddy a little bit. And he went after the show. He said, Buddy, I do this TV show called Fernwood Tonight. It's a funny show. I think you'd really enjoy it. You should come to a taping tomorrow. And he said, Buddy said, "What time do you guys tape?" And he said, 11 o'clock in the morning. And Buddy said, 11 o'clock? I wouldn't get up that early to see me play. It just stuck with me.
So we were auditioning bass players, and this guy came to audition who actually didn't get the gig, but he said, "I've got this friend, Ace Frehley, and he's looking for a drummer for his solo record." And, you know, because I'd been out of the rock world, I wasn't really even much aware of Kiss at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to me, they were a band on the side of a bus. You know, I'd see the big post on the side of a bus. And so I went up and played with him, and I did a couple of rounds of demos, and then he asked me to do his record, and his record came out really, really good. Mm. A lot of stuff, you know, I found happened, you know, you do one thing and it leads to another. Like I auditioned for some other band because their drummer was going off to play with Dylan.
And through that, their producer got me to Link Ray. And then the producer got me to Joan Armour Trading, and I did those records. And ended up playing with Link for a long time, and I did the Me, Myself, I record, which is one of Joan's biggest records.
Yeah.
So one thing led to another, and then I started to work in New York a lot. You know, Cyndi Lauper, I played a few cuts on a Dylan record. I played on Jagger solo record, a few cuts. And I started to kind of really get around.
Yeah. And jumping back to Ace, and so it was working with on Ace's solo record that, for whatever the reasons were, that at the time, the producer or whoever felt that Peter Criss couldn't fulfill his obligation to do the record, that they brought you in to do.
I think I don't know the exact story, but I think he broke his arm or something and he couldn't play and they had to do it. And they got me into play. And then, you know, after I did Dynasty, and after Dynasty, I did Unmasked. And I think that's because they must have broken his other arm. But I'm not sure. But anyway, I got to do those two records. But the one thing that was nice about it was they didn't really, you know, I didn't know them as well. I knew Ace really well. I was good friends with Ace, you know, we've got to be really good friends from the solo record. And no one really told me what to play. They just let me interpret the music however I wanted to. So it wasn't like, you got to play this way, this is how Kiss sounds and all that. They just let me just kind of play. Yeah. And it's funny, recently I went back. I haven't listened to those records since those days. But, you know, my son has got me into listening to a few cuts here and there again. You know,
that's cool. Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
And at the time, you weren't credited, right? That was like in those days, that was
at the time, those were the days when people could keep a secret. Apparently, in these days, that's impossible. But there, it was just like, we're going to play on the record. We're going to pay you really well, but you can't tell anybody. Shake hands. That was it. And I didn't. I never told anybody until... I think a Kiss book came out by Gene, I think, and it said that I played on Unmasked. And then they released a remastered version of Dynasty, and it credits me on drums. So then after that, I said, fine. They put it out there first, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much common knowledge, but it was always a very quiet thing.
He was so non-competitive, and he just wanted to help other people. He just loved people, and he had a huge, huge heart. And really, I mean, like I said, you know, I mean, I can count people like that I've met on one hand, subtracting a few fingers, you know. Steve Gadd would be another one. Steve Gadd would be in that company. And really, I mean, it's like we'll talk about heart. And honestly, Steve, I have to tell you this. You know, you need to know this, man, because, you know, you're of that ilk. And for that, you know, amongst hundreds of other things that I could say right now, I have the utmost respect, you know. So but again, back to Jeff, you know, he would do things like that. Like one time, I remember I was playing at the Baked Potato, and And, you know, he showed up, and there was like the stage is this weird little kind of there's this kind of a wall that goes halfway. Like if you're the drummer and you're in the corner, there's this sort of thing that goes up to you, maybe waist high, and people are sitting there and they're sort of looking at you, and you know, it's like a partition or something, like a, I don't know. And he was sitting there, and so I was playing, and you know, and I'm playing, and for quite a while I had my eyes closed, so you know, I couldn't see what was going on, and I think sweat was getting in my eyes, and all of a sudden I felt something was wrong, with the left foot because it was pressing the hi-hat pedal and nothing was happening. So I kind of opened my eyes and I looked to see what was going on. And I looked down because I was pressing the hi-hat and nothing was happening. And I just happened to look down and Jeff must have somehow crawled, and I'm not sure where he did it. But yeah, he must have either crawled over the pass-through or went around the front of the stage, and I looked down, and he was on the floor, on his back, looking up at me, fixing my hi-hat pedal. And seriously, and I looked down, and he was on his back, looking up at me, and when I looked at him, he just busted out laughing, and I started laughing, and you know, I think maybe I stopped playing for bars or something, and we were both just cracking up, and I'm like, "What are you doing in the middle of a tune?" And so that's what he was like. That was just one thing, and he would do the same thing, like Rick said, where, you know, he'd call me up and say, "I had a gig at the Potato, like now, can you make it?" Or he would say, "Gary, how are you? I haven't seen you in a million years. I see you." And it's Gary Grimm, and it's really good to see you. So many people here now. And he would do things like that, or he would say, "You know, I've got a session. You know, I can't do it. I've already told him about you, recommending you." And, you know, I would turn up at the session. It would be like Stan Getz or some major thing like that, you know, and he just didn't care. He would put his reputation on the line, or, you know, he would lend me his drums to use for sessions, and it just,
you know, we've heard these songs a million times. And I said this the other day, like all the rooftop concert, you know, the Let It Be, I saw bits and pieces of the original Let It Be movie, and of course have owned the record for, you know, 50 years. And so heard those recordings a million times, but when you see them playing live, there's something, and you guys that have seen it, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, there's this element of like unbelievable appreciation
and for each other.
Yeah. And for them, I mean, when you see them performing these songs live, and how they get to that point, the fact that it's 3 weeks of kind of getting almost nowhere for two of those 3 weeks. Yeah. One of the guys quits the band during that time.
Yeah, it's very tedious.
Part
of that.
It's that this close to imploding, like on several occasions. And then they go out to the rooftop and they sit down and they play their asses off. I mean, they just... You know what I mean? It's like, it's the quintessential, like playing for the red light. That red light's on and they're so pro and they're all such great musicians and such a great unit. And it's almost like, I don't know, I can't explain it, but it's like they defaulted to all those years of playing together. That just came out.
Especially
Ringo.
A contributing factor, I'm going to chip in here, John. Can be overestimated what all that time in Germany did for all of them.
For sure.
In terms of making them,
yeah,
you know, it's that thing about where in an ideal situation that all of us are in varying degrees, where you transition from a bunch of good musicians playing together, and then in an ideal world, after a certain amount of time, the whole becomes greater than the sum of the parts. And I think they reach that in Germany. So by the time they, you know, the overnight fame in England,
yeah,
they had all that. They were a unit. They, mm-hmm. I'm sure you've all seen that great story that Paul talks about when the first time they play with Ringo, and they basically look, the three of them look at each other and go,
"That's it.
He's the guy." Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, with all due respect to a certain Mr. Best, you know, I mean, it just upped the ante.
But again, I've always been fascinated with what little I know about you playing on It's Only Rock and Roll, But I Like It, which I remember I'd learned that sometime in the early 80s, then I bought Max Weinberg's book, The Big Beat, where you were he interviewed you, and you talked a little bit about that. And and I know that it was a song that Mick Jagger and Ronnie Wood were sort of jamming on, and they rang you up to come and play, right? Basically to put a reference track, like a...
Well, it was a song. I hadn't even started, really. So when I get this call from Ronnie saying, Kenny, we haven't got a drummer. And oh, blimey. I was just always cool when I got one leg into bed. And I lived on Richmond Park. We both lived all around Richmond Park. And at night, they closed the gate to Richmond Park. So for me to get to Woody's, going across the park, would take me 2 minutes. Go all the way around is it more like 15 minutes or a bit longer, 20 minutes. But also, I'd had a drink, so I didn't want to get caught for drink driving. So it was a tense moment getting there. I get there. One night, it would be Bob Dylan there, you know, another night it would be Eric Clapton, whatever. This particular night, it was just Jagger, Mick Jagger. So he just, hello, Kenny, how are you doing? Yeah, great. So we started playing. And it was just playing away. And Ronnie was in the control room working at the engineer, doing the engineer bit, because he'd just got a load of outboard equipment, new stuff. So he's playing around with that. He said, keep playing, keep playing. So just me and Mick together. Yeah. And suddenly we hit this groove. And Mick said, play it like that. And I went, okay. So I said, it's too late. I'm going to play it like this. I said, anyway, it's only rock and roll. So we kept buzzing around. That's how it happened. And we ended up sort of playing it. I just thought nothing more of it. Went home the next day. Forgot all about it.
Wow.
Then I got a call saying, oh, you're on the Stones album. I said, what? And they said, well, it's only rock and roll, but I like it. And it says they're single. I went, oh, what? So I called up Charlie straight away. I said, Charlie, I'm really sorry. I never meant this to happen. I would never be, you know, stealing anyone's thunder like that. And he said, all right, it's all right, Kenny, don't worry, because this is the special thing about Charlie. He was such a lovely gentleman. I said, Kenny, it's okay. Sounds like me anyway. So yeah. Good old Charlie.
Oh, I know. Bless him. I know. Yeah. No, I'd heard that story. Yeah. And it does sound like him. But
funny enough, I was thinking about Charlie when I was playing it. So when you think about that, Charlie, I play Charlie.
Well, it's an amazing track, Kenny. I think, you know, if you had only recorded that one song, I think it puts you at the top of the mountain, I think, because it's such, the feel is so impossible.
It's a great feel. I like the feel. Nick. I tell you why. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was bloody tired.
That's the key.
Let's just keep everyone up late. Really, sort of keep the drummer up late, because when you get really tired, you're kind of so far behind the beat.
do you recall? I mean, do you know if the version that we hear on the song, is that like, did you do a bunch of takes, or were there just a couple of takes,
don't forget, it was a bit more, it was late, and it was just a quick sort of rough demo type song, you know. Yeah. I didn't even think they were going to keep it, you know. So
yeah.
I think we just probably ran through it a couple of times, that's it.
Well, you know, I had the drummer Andy Newmark. I don't know if you know Andy.
I know Andy.
Yeah, you know Andy. I had Andy on with me a few months ago. We were talking about that because he had done some of Ronnie's solo record, I think just before that. And we were talking about you, and I said, I hope to someday talk to Kenny about this. But he recalled there being he recalled a Ludwig kit that, like, Ronnie had set up in his studio. He said it might have been one of your old kits, maybe.
No, I gave him a drum kit, which is the worst thing I ever did. That's why he called me up a big time.
So it was one of your old Ludwig kits?
I think it's a blonde one.
You think it's a... Oh, your blonde one?
Yeah, Ludwig, I think.
The maple one, yeah. And do you, I know this is really pushing my luck asking you these questions, but do you remember what the symbols were? I'm guessing they were pasty something.
I would have thought in those days it would have been pasty. Yeah. And I kind of, if I liked a Zildjian, I'd just mix and match them.
Yeah. I mean, it's the hi-hats and the like the crash that you hit a lot. I mean, it's...
It's sound edge, you know,
And,
you know, luck favored me.
And as far as the audition, did you have to submit something to get to that point where Frank...
No, I just happened to pick up the phone at this place I was crashing at because I got a phone number from Tom Fowler for the management. I called them up. And they're like, go away, kid. And then, you know, one day I happened to be there during, and this is before answering machines. That's how old I am. Okay. So the phone rang and I just happened to be there and I picked it up. They said, the real deadpan. Hello, is this so-and-so? You know, yeah. Mr. Zappa will hear you Tuesday night. Culver City Studios, 7 p.m. Click. Or it was like that. So I showed up and it was like a cattle call. I mean, literally. Yeah. Big movie studio, and there's like probably three lines, 100 deep, you know, and yeah, and that's what it was like, and you know, I walked up there, and finally I got towards the head end of the front of the line, and I was just like, here I go, sink or swim, and just you know, you went through the laundry list with him, and I got hired. So,
yeah. You're being way too humble because it's a classic legendary story. You had to play on Terry's kit, right? His Roto Tom.
Yeah, kit? Yeah. He that's double bass Gretsch kit, black kit, and I had never played double bass before, so I was like, "Whoa," and I did, but it was great. I was like, "Oh, Gretsch drums, yeah," you know. So, they're Gretsch, yeah, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, and then great. The laundry list happened, you know, and it's like, and yeah, and so it was, yeah, it was. It was really very, very grueling and you know, meticulous audition, you know, where it was all these categorical things he wanted to make sure that they could be fulfilled. And whether or not he was looking for all of them or a high percentage of them to be filled, I don't know. But I must have ticked all the boxes. So, you know, that's lucky me. So, yeah, you know.
I think you did, Vinny. I think you did. There's...
yeah,
and knowing who your dad was, I mean, you had to know early on, like the impact that he had. He was so larger than life. Like, was it like I don't know?
I mean, again, people do ask me that question a lot, and it wasn't probably until I was a little older. You know, when I was a little kid, I mean, that's your life. You know,
yeah.
Jerry Lewis coming over and, you know, having all these celebrities coming to the house, it was just normal life to me. Yeah. But then I think once I got in like junior high and high school, people made it different for me because people reacted differently. So, yeah. You know, he was on TV all the time and he was doing, you know, he was touring all the time. So that's when I kind of went, oh, okay. So my life is probably a little different than most people. You know, when friends would come over, he would have played all night, so he didn't get home until 4 a.m. So he was still sleeping when I got home from school. So if friends were coming over, you'd be like, and they're like, your dad's sleeping? It's 3 o'clock. You know? Well, yeah, he worked until 4 a.m., right?
In that regard, my dad's a drummer. And then the kids would go, what, does he think he's Buddy Rich? No, he is Buddy Rich.
Jason Bettner, Neil Peart, I stick my hand out. I said, Mr. Peart, it is an absolute honor to meet you. And he grabbed my hand with both hands and he said, I hear we have a mutual friend in Nick Raskolenis. And that's all he had to say. That's all he had to say. And it opened up the floodgates. There was no awkwardness. There was no nothing. It was, this is the drummer who worked with my producer before I worked with him. Because that's really what it was. I was the guy who was being produced by his producer before he was.
That's so cool.
You know, so we talked about Nick and working with Nick and we were both laughing at Booge, which is I experienced Booge before he even called him Booge. So it was just we had that kinship already.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
not only did we start talking about drums, he goes over to his practice kit and he goes,
because we start talking about him studying with Peter. And he goes, you want to see what I'm working on? And I'm like, what? He goes over to his kit, puts a metronome on, and he starts showing me the exercises he's working on with Peter Erskine. And I'm going, yeah, this is not happening right now. Wow. Like, seriously, like, I'm just thinking of my mic in my ear. Don't ask him about drums. And I'm like, I didn't ask him. He's showing me right now.
Man.
So he's just showing me this shit. And I'm going, this is amazing. And I, like, it was 10 minutes, but it felt like it was forever. And I said, Neil, look, we got to go. We're going to get out of your hair because I know it's your warm up time. He's like, no, it's all good. I'm like, no, I know how precious this last half hour is. It's like, I know you know, he's like, no, we're fine. Just stay a couple more minutes. And we're talking. I'm like, well, would you mind signing my snare drum? He's like, sure. So he's sitting on a chair. He's looking at the snare drum. And I'm wondering what he's reading. I'm like, what are you reading? He's like, oh, I'm just looking at what you wrote on your snare drum. He goes, I like to read people's snare drums when they write notes on there and stuff. I had like a set list or something written on there and like some music notation for something. I said, I think it was like a solo part or something I was working on. And he goes, oh, it's good that you can write it out. So it was just cool, you know? So he goes to sign it and I go, whoa. And he goes, what? I go, can you sign the drum for me? He goes, oh, you want me to sign the shell? I go, oh, absolutely. I said, you can sign that head. Someone stupid could take the head off and get rid of it. I said, no, I want you to sign the drum. Jason, happy drumming. Neil Peart.
So it's a different time. And obviously what's gone on the last 2 years has made it incredibly more difficult, but the, sure.
Yeah.
As far as finding talent, you know, it's a weird time because I was just talking to someone about this the other day, Gary Novak and I were talking and actually I've had this conversation with a lot of people. So I just remember the last one being with Gary, but used to sign people because they were the gig they were on, right? They had a great gig. So you get exposure for the brand and blah, blah, blah. And that's still relevant, right? But now you have this whole new venue in the digital space. You know, you have all the social media and all that stuff is a new venue. It's where you have to go where the people are hanging out. Sure. And that's where the kids are hanging out, right? So you have all these people who have like a bazillion followers, but they've never played a gig in their life. Like, I mean, when I say a gig, like they're not like, I'm not playing with Journey or I'm playing with Chick Corea or I'm playing with Santana or whatever. There's very few, there's less of that. Mm-hmm. There's more of the digital thing. And it doesn't mean they're not talented. And they're very talented. In fact, sometimes they're doing stuff that like no one's ever been able to do. But you're like trying to juggle like this, like you have, you want people who actually can, I mean, there's a lot of talented people that can't play a gig. And you're like, well, what's important? What's not important? It's like, well, if you don't have the brand's exposure in front of all those people on the digital platform, someone else is going to have it. And so you're juggling this integrity thing when it comes to one side and then, but there's integrity on the other side, but the two integrities don't always jive. Does that, am I making sense?
Like, no, it makes sense. I was seeing it, Joe, when I was still there. I was seeing it was starting to move in that direction. And in the 9 years now that I haven't been doing it, I know it's really evolved. It's really grown. And I think you summed it up perfectly. You know, that is a genre now, you know, that's like, you know, when I was doing artist relations, you had rock and you had jazz and you had Latin and you had all these different genres and that's kind of its own genre now. So,
Still the four pillars. So, you know, I look at four main things and it's more complicated, but to dumb it down, there's like, you look at personality, you look at exposure, you look at loyalty and you look at talent and a combination thereof, right? Like if a guy is a jerk, but he has all the other three, but he's a jerk, I'd rather him be someone else's jerk.
You don't get to be at our level by doing the wrong thing over and over again. And I have a certain way I like to do things, and I have a certain vision of excellence that I expect from myself and everybody else that works there. You really need to know what you're talking about, and you need to show up with your head on, and you need to be accountable. And sometimes that's hard to convey to drummers. Yeah. I had to learn it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I had to learn it. But it's hard to find those people. It's a needle in the haystack kind of thing to find an employee that has all those things and the passion for drums.
Right.
Because you got to be into it.
You got to be into it. Yeah.
You got to be into it. Otherwise, you might as well just go work at Leechmere. Well, right. Won't work at Leechmere, but Hannaford, Market Basket.
No, but to your point, I mean, it's great to have guys on staff that are drummers, guys or gals that are drummers. I mean, that's, but at the same time, there's got to be a level of commitment from them beyond, you know, like it can't be, oh, I got to go put in my 8 hours at Drum Center today before my gig tonight. It's really, they've got to show that commitment to being on the job, showing up on the job. And I totally understand that.
Yeah.
Not, you know, it's not that much different from the other side of the industry too, like in the, you know, manufacturer side where there's drummers, musicians working at drum companies, but you know, you're there to do a job every day. You can't be wearing your, I got my gig tonight, my band's going to get signed to a record deal hat every day at your day job.
Yeah. Right. And that's the biggest surprise that the people have if they get a job with us, they, you know, they'll say, oh, they might say, oh, it must be such a fun place to work. And I'm like, yeah, but it is fun, but you need to understand we bust our butts.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some people that they don't come back for day two. that wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Right. Yeah.
They think they could just sit around and play drums all day. And it's not how it is.
Yeah.
You know, I had a question actually for you, Jim, because I've heard, you know, everybody knows Charlie does that thing where he comes off the snare drum, which I love. And I love the sound it makes, you know, when you hit the, I know that he probably does it to like, you know, so that he doesn't crisscross, but I also just love the way the drum sounds when it's hit by itself. You know, you get this beautiful tone. But I had heard somewhere that that you saw Levon Helm do it, and then Charlie saw you do it, and that's where it came from. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe
that little story is that's right. I should have remembered that a minute ago. The thing is, when I met Levon, he changed my course, the course of my drumming. In a big way.
Yeah.
And we would sit and talk and he would say, God damn it, Jim Lee, I played all those damn little things that you played, man. And I said, oh, Levon, if I could just hit the floor tom and make it be in the right spot and sound the way you do, man, you know, so we had that kind of relationship. And so he affected me deeply. And when I would see them play in the studio or live, he always did that. He always brought the hi-hat, the hi-hat stick up off the backbeat. Mm-hmm. And so I don't remember actually trying to do it. It just infiltrated my playing, and then I started doing it. And so I didn't really start for any other reason other than just watching Levon do it. And then years later, Charlie told me that he started doing it from seeing me on the Bangladesh film doing it. And I thought that was hilarious. And then Steve Jordan started doing it because he saw Charlie doing it.
The drum chair on the Letterman show, Steve Jordan leaves the band, it becomes available. And did you audition for that?
What happened there was, you know, Steve would take off quite a bit. And often Charlie Drayton played.
Yeah.
And they were both out of town. You know, it could have been around the time they were playing with Neil Young. I'm not sure. And so I would see Paul around town and I would always say, let me sub on the Letterman show. And he'd say, oh, you'll get your chance. But it never happened. And then I actually did Paul Butterfield's last record with Paul Schaefer. And like, I still didn't get called. And I'd done Joan Armatrading's record with Paul and nothing happened. Anyway, one night I was playing with Robert Gordon and Chris Spedding and they came down. And I knew they were checking me out. And so Paul asked me to, he said, Steve's going to be away for a week. Can you do a week on the show? I said, sure. So come down and rehearse. I did the rehearsal. He said, actually, he's going to be away for 2 weeks. Can you do 2 weeks? I said, absolutely. So I did the 2 weeks. Steve came back. Then one day, Steve just showed up really late, and they called me, and I ran right on stage and played the show till Steve came, and then he took over. And then a week or two later, Paul calls me up and said, Steve is leaving the show, and the show's yours if you want it. And so I said, well, I have to think about it. I know I didn't.
So we all realized within an hour that he was totally together and on his game, and that there was 5 years out of the studio didn't matter at all. He knew what he was doing, knew exactly what he wanted to do, how he, and you know, his main message to me was always, he couldn't remember my name in the beginning. He couldn't remember any of our names. We were all new people, except for McCracken. He knew Huey. But he'd say, drummer. He said, look, I will remember your name soon, man. So forgive me for calling you drummer. And then Jack Douglas would go, oh, it's Andy. It's Andy. Okay, Andy, sorry, man. Listen, I will get your name eventually. Listen, Andy, when in doubt, play like Ringo.
Yeah.
That's all he had to say. When in doubt, play like Ringo. He's my favorite drummer. And that gave me all the guidance I needed. It was like, okay, now you know what not to do. Because Ringo is a completely emotional player. It's all emotion and groove and minimal fill. It's just beautiful accompaniment and support of the song with no decorations and no little drummy, little frilly, little musician chopsy, little bullshit things. You know, none of that, those, whatever you call all that stuff, the decorations that have nothing to do with real heartfelt groove. Once he said play like Ringo, I knew to stay away from anything drummy. And I knew the Beatles records, and I knew how.
You know, when we were on a couple of weeks ago, we had the whole group of guys. Mickey Curry was saying how great you sound, how great the band sounds, and you know, we were honoring Charlie that day. But I wanted to mention that again, that, and Mickey and I were talking about that offline too. How you're just killing it. There have been so many guys that have sat in that seat. You know, obviously Steve Jordan and Matt Chamberlain and Chris Parker and yourself, of course. But you've like, that band is just, it's just like so well oiled now, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a, what an incredible chair that, I mean, the people that have played, like you said, Steve Jordan, and then Steve Ferroni did it for a while as well. Yeah. And Buddy Williams.
Yeah.
You know, in the beginning, I think there was some cats would come in and out, like I think Gad and different people, Weckl, you know, came in and subbed different times, you know, and it's just an incredible group of musicians, you know, because it's sort of cats that are based in New York and that were sort of working in the studios and the tradition of that. And when I first started in 92, GE was running the band and kind of got the gig through an audition with Matt, you know, Matt Chamberlain had done it for years, obviously. Such a great musician, and decided to leave after a year. And so they had some auditions, knew the bass player that was doing it. And we had an audition over at SIR on 25th Street here in New York. And man, it was a wild audition. It was sort of just show up and G started playing. And then Paul, the bass player, Paul Solo was there. It was just the three of us. And G just started playing and you just, you know, it was swim or drown, you know, so just, you know, get down and whatever was happening. I mean, it was nothing like, hey, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. He would just start playing and you just had to get down, you know? And I felt the audition I felt went really great. Cause I'd been doing a lot of gigs that were sort of in that wheelhouse, like a lot of blues gigs and then the rock thing. And I think G wanted somebody that was sort of hit kind of big, and but it was also kind of simple and straight ahead in a feel that feel was a priority, you know, and then mm-hmm. also someone that maybe had a wide range that could cover a lot of bases, you know, and play brushes, and you know, if you had to swing a big band types chart, you know, and so kind of a broad range, which was really fortunate how I came up then and all the different things I was exposed to really seemed yeah. to be a plus in that way, you know, at that point, you know.
If you haven't seen the film that Denny directed, The Wrecking Crew, then it's available. You can watch it on Netflix still.
No, it's not on Netflix, but I'm excited. But wait, someone sent me a note the other day. It's on HBO now, HBO Max.
Oh, fantastic. Even better.
Yeah, so I hope so.
Yeah.
We'll find out in March if I get a check. We'll see. hope so.
I can watch
it. All right, so here's the thing. All your audience, go to HBO Max. I don't care if you've seen it before or whatever. Just give it a thumbs up, okay? Yeah. That's all I need for Christmas.
Yeah, please. Please do that, and I'll do the same thing, yeah. I've watched it so many times. You were so nice to send me, you know, I think even before the DVD was finally.
Oh yeah. You saw years before we finished it.
Yeah. And, but I can watch it over and over, and I can hear the stories over and over because they're so great. And I know I'll mess these up, but there are a couple that your dad tells. There's one in particular, and please correct me if I don't. But it has to do with the Wrecking Crew going in to do this really legit into a soundstage, maybe at Universal, and doing a movie, and they were doing the score for a movie, and there was a composer who put music in front of them and said, "All right, now this is."
Oh, okay, all right, yeah, that's the Disney story.
Disney.
Because Hal tells that story. Hal said. It was right, you know, because at the time in the late 60s, there was still about, it was, there was, you know, still that, oh, you guys do records.
Yeah.
You know, there was that. Well, the guy at Disney needed some rock and roll for this movie. It was, I can't remember. It was whatever the movie was. So what they did is they got rid of all the rest of the legit players, the strings and all that. And they brought in Hal and Dad and whoever it was, the combo. And he goes, "All right, guys, I'm going to lay down the music. We're going to take, you know, the click track, and we're going to slow it down so you guys can learn it." And he goes, and then they counted it out, and they just went boom, 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 and finished it. And that was it. And then the guy was like blown away by, "How'd you guys do that?" And my father says, "Oh, we practice a lot during the day." You know, so my father had no shame. I mean, he, you know,
we're hanging, Connecticut.
That's right.
Johnny D, Danny Serafin, Steve Smith. It's only the beginning.
Danny?
Steve, don't stop believing.
I
okay?
won't.
Just don't Johnny? Stop believing.
I'm feeling stronger every day, and the wheel in the sky keeps on turning.
All right, well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms, so download it. And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live From My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right. Again, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you again real soon. See ya.